Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 23rd, 2002. Today's session is titled Latin American Feminist Theology, and it is presented by Wanda DeFelt. The number is DEW2002-07. Let's listen in.
Okay, my name is Wanda DeFelt. I'm from Brazil, and I'm a professor at Lutheran Seminary there in the city of São Leopoldo, which is right next to the city of Porto Alegre, which is one of the largest cities in our region, south of São Paulo, if that is of any interest to you. Our subject today is feminist theology in Latin America. It is a subject that has to do also with the importance that women play in our church and in society. Even though women's position is not acknowledged publicly, neither in the church nor in society, but it has to do with that and also the attempt, especially of women, to bring about changes in our context. The word feminist theology was adopted for the first time in December 1993 at a regional consultation of the Association of Third World Theologians, the women's chapter of it, and the regional chapter, meaning to say Latin America and the Caribbean. That means to say that the wording is recent. It's less than 10 years that we are calling our theological endeavor as being a feminist theology, even though feminism had been the practice that we had adopted beforehand. And it was a subject in many of the liberation theologians, but as I explained to some people in private or in conversation or even the session yesterday, women's issues, the issues of the indigenous population or of the slaves or of sexual identity were not a very strong point of liberation theology. It was much rather developed in other contextual theologies that were that sprung from liberation theology in se, per se. And that, by adopting this terminology only in 1993, I also want to make clear that there is a very substantial difference with the way that theology is done in our context. If you read any main theological stream nowadays, whether it be, you know, feminist theology or womanist theology, these are always identified by major publications by individuals. So you say, yeah, the beginning of feminist theology in the United States was when Mary Daly published her book Beyond God the Father. And then in the biblical field, when Elizabeth Schisler Fiorenza published In Memory of Her. In the ecological sphere, when Rosemary Ruther published, first of all, New Woman, New Earth, and then Beyond, then Gaia and God, and so on. And in systematic theology, when she published Sexism and God Talk. So you see, it's always based on an individual's production, and that establishes then different stages in theology. Our theology, first of all, because most of us are very much like hands-on. Most of us spend a lot of time doing grassroots work. We do a lot of, we are resource persons for many popular movements. Like the Ecumenical Decade of the Churches in Solidarity with Women, Christian-based communities, and other networks. Our theology is, we almost don't have time to publish. So it's interesting that the stages in feminist theology in Brazil are marked very much by the gatherings, the consultations, the get-togethers that we have. And then it's made communally. Like you take 3 to 5 days and then a big statement comes out of that. That's why this sort of representative, because it also means a collective effort that is beyond it. And I think it's very different. I mean, it's already a different mentality if you come to think about it. But then still in the writings and in the consultations that happened all throughout the 70s and 80s, the terminology, women's theology and feminine theology had already appeared before feminist theology, even though feminist theology as well had been present in the literature and in the memory that we have of our get-togethers. First, women's theology, something that started in the 70s and early 80s, recognition that liberation theology did not address women, and that women's voices and experiences were needed also to make that a more representative way of dealing with theology proper. But then, what would that contribution be? And the acknowledgement was, well, there is something to be said about a feminine perspective over against the dryness and the dullness of traditional male theology than would be women's tenderness, passion, compassion as a contribution unique of women to theology. And of course we critique that as well, saying, well, that still stereotypes women very much, you know, as if they were restricted to one side of the brain and not as full human beings. And that is why feminist theology was officially adopted in 1993 at EATWAT, the Ecumenical Association of the of Third World Theologians. Some of the theologians that I have named here, Yvonne Jabara, she's a Roman Catholic nun. She got into trouble with the Vatican recently because she publicly defended women's right to choose about women's bodies related to reproductive issues. So she was awarded with a year of silence as well, which is how the Vatican punishes when its leaders, you know, do not condone with what is said or the critiques that are presented. So Yvonne Jabara is maybe one of our leading theologians at this point, also for her, for the fact that she's so brave and outspoken on these issues. And then there is Elsa Tamis, she's from Costa Rica. She's a Methodist professor. And she has already published many books, and especially as a Bible scholar, helped to put women in the forefront also in that area. And then I mentioned Ana Maria Tepidino, and Nancy Cardoso Pereira, and Tânia Mara Sampaio, all of them also representatives of Brazilian feminist theology. And that last name might look familiar to you. My work especially has been quite influential in the discussion of ethics and how does that relate to women's situation in the church and in society in Brazil. So it's all very simple. We do not have lots of pretensions. When we only want to make a difference in women's lives, and that's what we aim at. That's what we are about. We run into a lot of trouble, but as a woman, a Catholic sister once told me, in both in church and in society, it's easier to get forgiveness than to get permission to do anything.
Yeah.
So we just go ahead and do what we think that is correct, that is Christian, that is ethically bound, and then we see the consequences later. And sometimes some of us have had hard times, but then I think there's a network all over Latin America that helps to support the work that we are doing. I would like to share how I became a feminist, and it's a quite a personal story. Most of my friends were quite dismayed when I assumed myself as being a feminist, because being a feminist in Latin America means that you do not get the top ranking positions. You don't get that public acclamation, because you give up on being successful in the power structures that are. And I was doing my practical work in a Christian-based community in the Amazon area. And I was living with a priest, a nun, and another pastoral agent who was doing health work. And the three of us lived in one of these very common, very type of houses that are typical of the Amazon area in the northeast part of Brazil. Our house was made with, the walls were mud, and the roof was straw, and the floor that we stepped was actually ground. So, and we didn't have electricity, we didn't have running water, and our bathroom, our toilet was like the ones that you use, you know, in the outhouses here when you go camping. To get water, we had to fetch it from the stream. To bathe and wash our clothes, we had to go to the stream and do that. So I was living in a very poor community, and I was very much part of that community for the time being. As I said, it was a Christian-based community, primarily Roman Catholic. And during the time I had been there, I had very close contact with people in the community, and in the village that we lived, there were maybe 20 houses maximum. And I was working one afternoon, and then into the village came a woman by the name of Maria. And Maria had about 32 years. She was 32 years old. And she was married, her husband had come with her, and she was pregnant, and this was her eighth pregnancy. And she had had three miscarriages, and so this would be the fifth child. And she had taken birth control pills, hidden from her husband, because she didn't want to get married. So she had done that, but the pills did not work because she was undernourished. And you know that malnutrition causes hormonal imbalance, and so she became pregnant even though she was taking the pills. There's something about, studies in medicine have confirmed that. There is something about, in all human life forms, when the nourishment, when there is a problem, there is the reproductive factor is augmented. Mm-hmm. Meaning to say, the more undernourished, the more probability of getting pregnant. That explains in great part why among the poor there is almost no fertility problem, because you know the poor seem to be proliferating and procreating much quicker than those that are well-to-do. You know, you come to realize that it's a fact. You know, there's no fertility problem among poor people, because women's bodies become much more prone to become pregnant. Well, so Maria had taken birth control pill, but it didn't work because she was malnourished. And she had come then to the village to have her baby. And so she was brought to the only house in the whole village that had a bed, because all of us slept in hammocks. And she was placed in that bed to have her baby, and immediately they called the medical doctor. And the medic, she lived in the nearby village, so she came But they realized that the situation was way too complicated, and so besides problematic, they also thought it was wise to call somebody from the church, you know, a priest, even a theological student, if it were, to make do when the doctor couldn't do any longer. So I volunteered to go. And I helped Maria then in delivery, because the medic and I were the two who helped to do that. It had been my first encounter with labor and its perils. First because, well, if any of you have assisted, if you have gone to labor, you know, as my mother-in-law says, no child, no woman gives birth laughing. So, unless you have a special medication for doing that, so of course it is very painful. But in her case, since she was, it is already a painful situation. And then in her case, because she was so weak, she couldn't hardly push. So we were trying to help her, and so this started at 2 or 3 in the afternoon and went way into the night. So finally, by 8 o'clock in the evening, she was able to deliver a baby. And it was a beautiful baby girl. And we were also amazed, in awe, that this baby was so perfect, you know, this beautiful fat cheeks, and it's like from this malnourished mother. And so as the baby was being washed and tended for, we were all getting ready to celebrate, but then Maria wasn't recovering because she started to bleed. And then she started with a hemorrhage, and there was nothing that we could do. So the doctor, you know, by chance, had in her bag medication that could stop the bleeding. And so she took out the needle, and she tried to find a vein in Maria's arm. And she poked her several times because the arms were so thin, she could not even find a vein. And then, after several attempts, she finally succeeded, and the medication then took effect, and the bleeding stopped, and you know, we could see because this one wasn't running on the floor and the ground anymore. Maria was slowly recovering, so I realized what the miracle that was. Not the miracle of a child being born, but the fact that the mother didn't die. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the biggest miracle of all. And years later, I came to think about that because, I mean, this is a story that marks me very much. It's like in the story of Jesus, because Maria is Mary. Mm-hmm. And you come to think about, can you imagine Mary being this poor girl giving birth, and not to baby Jesus, but to this girl, and, you know, the perils that she suffered. It really places her, has placed her in a whole different mindset, in my opinion, as well, because we idealize, we romanticize everything, including Christianity. And so then the doctor and I, we were, you know, very pleased that Maria was recovering, and, you know, her color came back to her, and she was, you know, coming around it, and the doctor, she said, Maria, if you have another experience like this, if you go through another pregnancy, and if you have not have to go through labor again, the chances are you will not make it. And she was very sincere in saying it. But then she said, well, you can, the clinic, because it was a community health clinic, the clinic could help in providing for a tubal ligation. And in those days, you know that internationally there are many agencies that offer to pay for tubal ligations in the third world, you know that. And she said, well, in this case, I think we could help, and there are means that this could be made. And Maria, she thought a little bit about it, and then she turned her face from us. She turned it toward the wall to avoid looking us into the eyes, and then she said, you have to ask my husband, because it's not up to me to decide. So, of course, the doctor, she would have to talk to him anyway, because such a procedure cannot be done without husband's consent, at least according to the law in Brazil. So she went outside, and I followed her, and she called him aside, and she explained to the husband what the dangers actually were. And then the husband said that he would not allow it. He said, what will my friends say if I don't put any more children into the world? My friends will think that I'm no longer a man. And if she dies, I'll find myself a younger one and even prettier. So I left the town the following days, because my time in the village was done, my internship was over, and that was my conversion, you know. That day I became a feminist, because I could not understand how, in God's name, a church, a society, could condone something like that. And I started to advocate for women's rights in the church, and since then, that has been my passion, because I think feminist theology, unlike how it is done in other parts of the world, but for us, feminist theology is the assurance of life. It's like it guarantees that women will survive, because there's no other theology that takes up this cause. So this is the day I became a feminist, and became very unpopular since. in dealing with some of the issues, I realized that taking Maria's example, I have worked since with many NGOs that deal with reproductive rights, women's rights, the issue of poverty, of violence. I realized since that there was something else. It's not only giving women the information about citizenship and the rights. And I realized that after 500 years, religion, especially Christianity, had done such a huge damage in women's lives, that Christianity was also one of the main responsible agents for keeping women in a submissive, very differential, very passive, subservient position. Why so? When the first Portuguese and the Spanish came to our continent, it is always portrayed like there was this romantic miscegenation between the indigenous, between the African women slaves. And I think only feminist theology, feminist theory, is able to point the finger and say, listen, the women in our continent have been raped. They have been exploited sexually. They have been exploited by their labor. And nowadays, we are led to believe that all the liberties and freedom that we have, and the fact that women's lives gear around men, that is a privilege. I think that's a condition that we have inherited since colonial times, and that Christianity did nothing to question it, and to the contrary, did much to say, well, this is women's position, by holding biblical passages saying women ought to be submissive, women ought to be silent, women are the second to be created, but the first ones to sin, all women are descendants of Eve, and therefore ought not to take any initiative, that women ought to be second-class citizens, both in the church and in society. And I think feminist theology has had that capacity, and also in challenging many of the ideas that are pre-established by Christianity itself. And how that is done? It is done by challenging through a method of deconstruction and reconstruction. Deconstruction means what we say in biblical language, that prophetic initiative of denouncing systems of injustice and announcing reconstruction and announcing a new order, in announcing a new reality, new possibilities. And that is what we do. We say what is wrong, and let women themselves say what they experience as being wrong. And many times they do not even dare to say something is wrong, because the church has told them, well, suffering is good, carry your cross, this will give you salvation. And then comes a theology that says, no, it's not good. I mean, you ought to have life abundantly, as Jesus wished for all of his followers. You are a child of God, and you deserve to be treated as an image of God, and not, you know, as a piece of trash, as most women are actually dealt with. And this is done through a method, and I've just named the three steps, very basic. First, and this is something that we do with women in very humble, simple conditions, grassroots women, and this is what we do with the same method that we use also in the university. We talk to our master's and doctoral students, and we talk about this with our male students at the seminary, which I think are very important agents also in bringing about change. First, I think, is the acknowledgement that women are excluded. Many times we look, and I think that's the tendency I perceive very much in your context, especially for the lack of interest in the issue of feminist theology in the North Atlantic setting, is, well, women have it all. You know, we have all the rights, we have all the privileges, we have all the capacities. You know, we have it. It's there for us. I mean, there is no longer a need for that. And I talk to this with students, especially who have become university students or who are doing their master's and doctoral work. I say, well, you see, women are very short of memory. Now, only in the 20th century have we achieved the right to vote. Mm-hmm. In Brazil, that has been 70 years that we are entitled to vote. It has been only the past century, only 100 years that we have had access to university. In Brazil, less than 50 years that women have had the right to own property. When my mom was growing up, she wanted to study, and it was said, my grandfather told her, well, you know, I think women's education is like throwing feathers in the wind, you know, I will never get back everything that I threw out of the window. Coming to say, it's not worth it. So when she got married, she received a cow and a sewing machine. It's like, yeah, that's what women were for, you know, like for being helpers, helpmates. And I think it's necessary to acknowledge, especially this generation, younger generation, that we need to have memory. If we have the benefits that we have today, it's not because they were given freely. Many women suffered a lot, because everything that we have nowadays is something that is a result of a conquest. It's a long struggle. And I think sharing that history, which brings me to the second point, reclaiming women in history and tradition, shows that, in fact, we did have a very strong presence. There is a memory there of what women have achieved, what women have done in the past. And that if we can stand strong today, it's because we are standing on the shoulders of others. But ours is a very individualistic society. And we tend to think, oh, it's my merit. Oh, it's because I'm so pretty. Oh, because I'm so intelligent. Because I know how to put my makeup in such a special way, you know, that the doors will just open for us. No, there are laws there to assure that you will not be discriminated. And if these laws are there to assure that, it's because it's like there's hundreds, thousands of women that are sure that this door will be open for you. But it's very, our mentality is so self-centered that we think, oh no, it's because I'm so special, you know, that I will have a place. And it's not. It's really not. And I think we need to learn a lot from our indigenous communities. And they say, if we are standing here, it's because there is a community behind us. If we are standing here today and we are entitled to speak in public, if we have a college education, if we are entitled to receive a payment for our work, then it's because there are people who supported us in this, you know? And I think in reclaiming women in the past, in history and tradition, also women in the Bible, which is a very important tool that we have used to show for the women, especially in our congregation, how the presence and the actions and the deeds of women in the past, biblical women, how they changed, how they shifted history as it was being made. And thirdly, establishing also new alternatives. I think that's important for us to say, well, we do not need to take everything for granted. Let's revise the society as we have it. And that is done in Bible, in ethics, dealing with issues of violence and poverty, in God language, in the way we deal with the church and how we envision a new church to be, and how we portray Jesus, how we deal with other theological issues, you know, like Trinity, how Mary is portrayed. And I think especially this one, which we call the Mariology, even for a Protestant, Lutheran, you know, in Latin America, I need to know about the cult to the Virgin Mary. It's like, it's so important in our countries. It goes from Guadalupe in Mexico to Aparecida in Brazil, and all Latin American countries have Mary as their patron. Do you notice that? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's the national saint. And we need to do a lot of work because that's our field, you know. Mary, that's our field. And we realized in trying to explain why things are the way they are, and explain and finding solutions for stories like that of Maria, is that in fact in Latin America, we have a very standard model of how men should proceed. Meaning to say, machismo. Machismo is patriarchy, kiriarchy, as Fiorenza would put it. That is how men's values ought to be in society. Meaning to say, men should be strong, take initiatives, a double moral standards are quite condoned. It's okay if a man leaves a woman and children because this is his nature. Men ought to be strong in politics, aggressive, many times violent to show their turf. That's machismo. And only recently has sociology come up with the understanding that what defines women's role in our society is Marianismo, which I put down here. Marianismo is the cult to Mary, the worship to Mary. And how Mary is so influential in defining what women's attitude should be like Mary, she ought to be virgin or mother. So Mary was a saint, she could be both at the same time, you know, virgin and mother. Meaning to say she's a role model impossible for most women to follow. But virginity or motherhood are the two only moral acceptable situations for women. If a woman is no longer virgin and not yet a mother, she's in problem, because meaning to say she's not married, she's having sex outside of marriage. If a woman is then no longer virgin, but she is married and not yet a mother, in that case, that's a problem, because the whole purpose of getting married is to have children. That's still the standard Catholic teaching about human reproduction, you know, where it led in the last in letters. Still, it was affirmed that the use of contraceptive methods are considered sinful. Well, then, and if a woman is a mother and is not married, that's also a problem, especially in the many, many cases of teenage pregnancies that we have. So you see all of these moral problems that are very well defined in this married situation, virginity or motherhood. But what I find most important is that in the cult to Mary, there is an ideal of sainthood that is attained through suffering, because Mary is the mother of Jesus and she suffered like no other mother. So the more women suffer, the more saintly they will get. Idealizing human suffering. If I can give an example, during the military dictatorship in Argentina, when the military took over and captured several people and put many in jail, especially young students, and the mothers, La Madre de la Plaza de Mayo, and mothers of the May Plaza, when they protested for the first time, one general came to them and said, "Why are you doing this? You should follow the example of Mary. You see, she gave her son without complaint. So why don't you just shut up and go home, you know?" Meaning to say, yeah, mothers ought to suffer. And the more a woman suffers, the more she is a saint. So nowadays in Brazil, this is so embedded in our culture. You can offend anybody. You can say anything to anybody. But if you touch somebody's mother's honor, I mean, you're that, because that is the saint, the most saint thing, the holiest thing that you can have is your mother, because mothers are saints, because all of them have suffered in the same way as Mary has. And that idealization of suffering, which was so misused by traditional theology, is harshly critiqued by feminist theology, meaning to say they are taking it lightly, not the suffering that is a consequence of a stance that one takes as a consequence of the actions that I proceed in taking, or as a result of a commitment that I make. Many things that I do may result in suffering. But they do that because they have a commitment to something, to a cause. Not that I voluntarily take the suffering, or that I impose that suffering on others. There's one thing if you take it for yourself, but it's something different if you impose suffering on other human beings. And I think that is one of the critiques that that feminist theology poses to traditional theology. Feminist has been taught at the Lutheran Seminary since 1990. feminist theology is one of the mandatory courses all students, male or female, need to take this class. So I'm the one who is responsible for teaching it, so I can say what a change does make in the theological curriculum. Every year, it's a one semester class. Every year, and I've been teaching that for 10 years now, more than 10 years, there is always a group of male students sitting in the very back row. They sit like this, their arms crossed, you know, that between skeptical and cynical outlook, you know. It's like, what is this woman going to teach us? And to my astonishment, year after year, these are the ones that come to me at the end of the semester and said, thank you so much. We have learned. I mean, this has changed our lives. Because if you do not have it as a mandatory course, you will only talk to those already converted to it.
Right.
I mean, you'll only talk to the women who are already feminists. And those who need to learn about it the most, you know, will not even show up. So in this class of feminist theology, we have introduced issues of domestic violence, for instance. The first time it was discussed at our seminary was in this class. And I remember when it was first brought up in one of the classes afterwards, and I presented figures, numbers, and I showed about the cycle of violence and all the bibliography that the students could get and how to have counseling intervention. And after the class, several students just grouped around me saying, teacher, I don't think we are going to bring this up in our church because, you know, this is not a very nice, popular subject. I said, well, I thought you were pastors not to be popular. I mean, I thought you had a mission. I thought you had a vocation, a calling. And this is one of the pains of our world. I mean, it's crying up to God, and it's up to you. And then the following year, one of the dynamics of our teaching at the seminary is that we have occasionally groups of students, like 20 students, that go out and do field work, and they research and do activities in congregations, and then after one semester they come back in this hands-on type of theology. And then they went to the city of São Paulo, which is the largest city in Brazil, although not the capital. And they decided, one group of women, they wanted to do interviews and research about the issue of domestic violence. And the pastors in that in the city, they all had gathered, you know, it's a large a roster of pastors, they said, well, that's a waste of time because domestic violence, that doesn't happen in nice Lutheran families. And the women said, okay, let's try. If nothing, if we don't find anything, you know, we still can change the subject, you know. And after 1 month, they interviewed all the, the ladies' aid type of groups in that parish. They went, you know, talked to all these, you know, very church-like women, and they came again to the, as the roster was meeting the pastors, started to bring the stories. And it was, every story was more dramatic than the next one. About abuse, about battering, about psychological abuse, about the hardships that women were facing. Or if it was not with themselves, then their daughters, you know, people that they knew, their neighbor. And the pastors had tears in their eyes as they said, why didn't these women come and talk to us? You know, we are their pastors. And the students cleverly said, well, you just never asked. And if you just present it beforehand, you know, that it's not there, of course you will never find it. It's like you have blinds in front of your eyes. And I think it's important to know that it is a theology that's making a difference. It's a very small attempt in the immense sea of needs that Brazilian people face. But I think it's a contribution. It's there. It's very humble, very provisional. Mm-hmm. Whatever we do, it's not wanting lots of merits, but just wanting to make a difference in people's lives. Any comment or question that you have?
Question. I just have a comment. When we were in El Salvador, of course, when the war occurred there, the revolution, you know, the women often had to take the place of leadership when the men were gone. Mm-hmm. You know? And even in the military, many of the women who fought rose to commandantes, you know, and were, you know, officers. And that was a very machismo society, El Salvador, mm-hmm. like all of Central America. And I don't know how much of it stuck, but you couldn't go completely the opposite way. Once the war was over, the women who had served in leadership roles continued to serve, and that was an example of women serving, and I think that had a lot to do with breaking down that mm-hmm. society in that way. And there, a lot of organizations of women were formed, you know, which carried on that idea of what you're talking about, you know, that they needed special health care and all kinds of things that women never had before, struggled now for it, and I think have been somewhat successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in El Salvador, I think something quite interesting happened. I've seen several reports on the return from the mountains, from the movements. Many women had been soldiers, and then in the times of peace, they had taken such a strong leadership during the time of war. There were comparisons between the same effect after World War II in this country. I mean, say now women were supposed to go home and simply be housewives and mothers again. And the women said, well, we don't want that anymore, you know. And there are some very interesting studies there, especially one NGO called Las Dignas. I don't know if you heard of it in El Salvador. It's very... I find it fascinating the work that they are doing, especially trying to find also political representation. It's one of the largest women's run NGO in El Salvador. And they deal with both the political aspects, the social aspects, the psychological effects that the war has had on women and on children. And then, of course, with all the Hurricane Mitch and all the earthquake that has, you know, really done so much damage in recent years. I mean, violence is an everyday experience, and how women and children are affected by that, and also the men are affected, so the attempt to do that. And I had an interesting experience in talking to some of the women in this NGO, and I was quite surprised with a similar situation that also happened in Brazil. The majority of these women came from a very strong Roman Catholic tradition. All of them had been very closely connected to liberation theology, and yet they felt suffocated, they felt stifled under liberation theology because the church did not offer space for women, even though liberation theology Christian-based communities were so open to affirm the rights of the poor. When it came to affirming the rights of women, there were lots of reservations. And that's a similar situation also in Brazil, where there's a very strong feminist movement. But that feminist movement wants to do nothing with the church. It's that the church has oppressed us way too much. You know, we are secular NGOs. And then comes feminist theology. And we have done all the readings that they all, we have a lot of contact. That's where we feed ourselves. And it was fascinating, the encounter with Las Dignas for me, as it has been for me, the encounter with, re-encounter with the feminist movement 10 years ago. They were surprised to find out, is there such a theology? We didn't even know God could be presented in different ways. You mean to say, actually, I mean, this is serious? I mean, that you have a space, I mean, that you are doing all this reading and that you can have a spirituality that affirms women's dignity? I mean, is that possible? And that, I mean, it has been really the beginning of a very beautiful friendship between the secular feminist movement and feminist theology in Latin America. So both in El Salvador and in Brazil, I have experienced.
Well, the Lutheran bishop, Madara Gomez, you know, is has a close affinity with, especially Milwaukee, and has been up often. And he, of course, is an advocate for women's liberation. And,
yes.
He is, he comes from a Missouri background, you know,
yeah.
Missouri Synod background, but he is now in ELCA, Lutheran Bishop in San Diego, El Salvador, but I think he has done my gigantic work to free women to be pastors and et cetera, you know, and theologians, and they are respected as such.
Is there anything happening in Brazil for liberation around sexual orientation identity issues?
Yeah, there's a very strong movement, gays, lesbians, transsexual, transgendered. It's the same, pretty much the same as you have it here, but that's from the secular setting.
Okay.
In the Roman Catholic Church, because that's what the media portrays as being the opinion of the Church, even though it's very close to what the Pentecostals would also say. It's like it's all sin, it's deviation, it's not biblical. Very interesting that even though, I mean, the Pentecostals and the Roman Catholics are completely antagonic on this issue. They're very ecumenical. I think there's an ecumenism of silence that goes on. It's universal. In that case, the separation between church and state has assured some of the rights for gays in Brazil, which I find are really the forefront. Just now, this year, was approved the civil union between gays. That's now legally approved. The Senate just approved that, over against the opinion of the National Council of Brazilian Bishops, where they were adamantly against it, because it means to sanctify what is sinful. But in that situation, I think the fact that Brazil is that we have a secular government, I mean, has weighted more. And there's a lot of social pressure, and this is election year in Brazil, so there's going to be much more openness this year than any other time. So, but in the church, and I'm very sorry to say, in the Lutheran Church, we have now, last year, we had a statement saying that the Lutheran Church of Brazil will not ordain gays, which I was really saddened by that. And it's, I think the churches tend to be quite conservative on that issue.
Does it even come up, though, in conversations in your feminist theology classes?
Of course, it's one of the major stuff.
I'm glad you at least talk about it.
Yeah.
You know,
which
I, grassroots.
I find it sometimes it's too much for feminist theology to take because we deal with everything.
Right.
You know, we deal with all the dirty subjects that nobody else wants to deal with. And so it feels like this gigantic laundry room, you know?
That's what women have done forever.
Yeah. And I, that's why at this point I'm quite pleased that one of the students that I accompanied all throughout the graduate studies, that he's now doing his master's and he's going for his doctoral work on the issue of ordination of gays and lesbians. So I think it's time to turn it over. And strategically, I found that very important. For instance, I hold the chair for 10 years. And if the tendency tends to be, at least in the Lutheran setting, if you ask any Lutheran in Brazil who is a feminist theologian, they will name me.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like very personalized.
Yeah.
And it's not. So how strategically also in theological formation, you need to form a new generation that is, you know, much more representative, because that's the way we do theology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm naming these women here, it's because, okay, we have had a chance to write a few more, you know, articles or little books, but it's much more community oriented than based on the personal issue. So I'm looking forward to what he is going to produce. Yeah.
Thank you.
What is the effect of children from the, you know, how women have been treated in Brazil?
Children. I think it's difficult for people in the United States to realize that the notion of family. Well, the same thing happens in Brazil as it happens here in middle class. The notion of family now is much more, it's up for grabs. People are still, the jury's out. People are still discussing on the notion of family. Now we have single parents, we have twice or thrice divorced, we have, you have all types of configurations. But something that a sociologist from Venezuela wrote recently, which I found quite fascinating, he said, our Latin American culture is one, and this also plays into this Marianismo notion. If you ask a man and a woman about who is your family, a woman will say her children. If you ask a man who is your family, he will go back and say his mother. And there is where the faithfulness lies. Because a man will not be, you see, there is a complete disencounter here. A man will always honor his mother. And he will always go back to the mother. Because the mother, it's a very matrilinear society. Women are very strong in that sense, in keeping the bond with the children. And the spouses, the male spouses, they are in and out, they're transitory, you know. And that's a concept of family that's quite fluent, especially in the popular sectors among the poor. You can find that a woman and her children are, that's the core of family, and everything else will work around that. And so you ask, a man will not feel accountable and responsible to his own children or to the spouse. That explains why men just come in and come out of relationships and why there needs to be a legal system there to say, well, you know, there's such a thing as alimony, you know, and pension, and, you know, paying for your kids' shoes, you know, because otherwise, they, in the culture, it's not built in. So, and how women will also not think about that as being such a crucial thing, because, I mean, it's they themselves and the kids. And that's where it goes. Mm. And then how women will very early want their kids to start working and even cutting them out of school. And how, in that, I was quite shocked in realizing that in a comparative study that we did between Argentina, Buenos Aires, and Porto Alegre, Brazil, on the issue of teenage pregnancy, how many girls got pregnant even knowing about birth control methods, but because, you know, they thought their mothers needed something to do. And so, and how many, and especially in the poor sectors of society, how many of the grandmothers will then be the mothers, and how it goes one generation after the other. So grandmothers take care of grandchildren while the mother can go and work. And that continues, like, it's generations and generations. It's fascinating to study it.
There was a segment on 60 Minutes, I think last year, where, I don't know if it was in Brazil or Argentina, I don't remember for sure, where bachelors, you know, who are doing well. I mean, they're quite wealthy, live with their parent, my mother, and she does the clothes and irons the clothes, and it was almost humorous, you know, because these were, you know, they were just like they were still at home, a kid at home, you know, and they were 30, 40 years old, and they were wealthy in their profession, but they still had the mother do the clothes for them and wash them and treat them just like you know, a son at home. You know,
yeah.
It was. Did you happen to see that? No. I
mean, no.
No. It was quite. It was almost the way they put it, but then it was quite humorous, because these were, oh, this is the way I like it. You know, the men would say, you know, I like to stay with mama, especially since she does my clothes and it feeds me. You know, she makes the meals for him and everything. And even though they were, you know, independently, you know, quite well off and even wealthy in some cases, but that kind of talks to what you were saying, you know, the son, the mother couldn't, would love it if the young man would stay with her for the rest of her life, I assume, you know, it would be okay with her.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, our time is up. Thanks for taping.